Hello and welcome to this episode 9 of my podcast, Family Law in the UK. My name is Natasha Slabas and I'm a partner at DMH Stallard LLP, based in their London office on New Fetter Lane. I now bring to you an episode to detail the circumstances under which a court will consider granting a legal services order. This is probably something that most people would like to be able to get if they can go to court, but they don't qualify for legal aid and they can't afford to pay their legal costs, because it would compel their spouse or the other side, if they're not a spouse, and I'll come to the sorts of arrangements and applications which are covered by a legal services order, because then they can avoid having to pay those costs themselves, at least up front. So, looking at the law, legal services orders are basically orders that provide interim funding for legal costs, and the regime is under the Legal Aid Sentencing and Punishment of Offenders Act 2012, otherwise known as LASPO 2012. And there are also various cases which underpin the sorts of reasons and procedures which should be in place for one to qualify in the first instance when making that application at court. Turning to the sorts of applications that do allow one to apply for a legal services order, you can do so if you are proceeding under Schedule 1 of the Children Act, which is, in simple terms, an application made by an unmarried mother for capital and maintenance provision to be provided for the benefit of a child by its father, for the purposes of the mother looking after that child during its age of minority. And they can also be used under Part 3 proceedings of the Matrimonial and Family Proceedings Act 1984, which are proceedings for an order to be made following an overseas divorce. In addition, they can be made on divorce and are commonly joined with applications for maintenance pending suit, which is where one tries to, in addition to getting their legal costs paid by their spouse, that the other side also pays for their day-to-day living pending the determination of the suit, hence maintenance pending suit. Now, looking at the underpinning framework, cases that governed maintenance pending suit for legal costs were quite different before LASPO came into place, because one would go to court and they would have to look at previous cases when asking for maintenance pending suit to ask for the judge's discretion to additionally cover their legal costs. And the first case to deal with that was the case of A&A, where Mr. Justice Holman said that the wording under Section 22 of the Matrimonial Causes Act 1973, which is the main legislative framework underpinning financial remedy proceedings on divorce, were wide enough to empower the court to include elements towards the payee's costs of the suit, provided it was reasonable to do so, which basically extended the court's power at that time, despite LASPO not being in place at that stage. And there was much debate from the years to follow, and the particular case of Moses and Tager of 2005 affirmed the decision, basically saying that it was not reasonable or fair for a litigant who was awarded maintenance pending suit to have to go into that pot to also cover her legal costs. I say her, and it's purely because it's more common, although obviously that's not to be discriminatory as to gender, it's applicable to either sex. Now we get to the Curry number 2 test, which was a case with Mr. Justice Wilson. And this case had a set of criterion to consider when deciding on whether an applicant should obtain a costs allowance, which is still looked at today, despite LASPO coming into place, obviously, after April 2013. And that was the following. Does the applicant have assets that it is reasonable for her or him, of course, to deploy to meet the litigation costs? So in other words, if you're thinking about going for the application, the court will want to know whether you have anything substantial which you could sell or monetize to enable you to pay for your own legal costs without making the application for a legal services order. Second point, could you raise a litigation loan? You need to have evidence from two lenders. In other words, you need to have two rejection letters from two financial lending institutions in litigation to say that you would not qualify for a litigation loan. And in order to get those letters, you need to contact the institutions. You can do so informally in the first instance to find out whether there's a chance. And then if there isn't, they'll put it in writing if you ask them to do it. And that is required on the application at court as evidence to show that you have been rejected from the two at least. Of course, the other side could challenge what information was imparted to the litigation lender to result in a negative letter, at which point you would be expected to provide any written correspondence between you and the lender asking for the loan. Hence, I suggest you do the informal phone call. If you have a solicitor acting for you, then the other side can quite rightly ask for a copy of the solicitor's attendance note, which they would usually keep if on the record and making those inquiries on your behalf. Third point, could you fund the litigation by way of a Sears Tooth charge? In that instance, a Sears Tooth charge is basically an agreement that, and a deed that will assign the settlement you get to the solicitor, so that they can be covered in their legal costs and then paid as a first priority charge, so to speak, in full on conclusion of your case. And that was in Sears Tooth versus Payne Hicks Beach and others in 1997. So you have to get from your lawyer, if you have a lawyer, confirmation that they will not fund the litigation. And if they don't put it in writing, you should put it in your statement in support of your application for the legal services order that they will not lend via a Sears Tooth charge. Fourth point, is public funding available that would give you the legal advice at the level of expertise apt to the proceedings? At the moment, there's very little legal aid available. I don't advise in legal aid anymore. I used to many years ago. But it is worth, if you think there's any chance of that being available to you, finding out from a legal aid lawyer. Fifth point, have you taken a stance in the litigation that is so unreasonable as to dissuade a court from ordering the provision? I.e., have you behaved reprehensibly in over-litigating by way of correspondence so as to ramp up costs? If that's the case, you may not get as much sympathy to fund your costs because it may be seen that you are deliberately escalating costs by having done so. So it's important you act reasonably. Even if you've answered all of the questions in the negative, it doesn't mean you're guaranteed an order that the other side pays for your legal costs. you must also provide a budget. So the budget will have a projection of the fees broken down, usually in a matrimonial finance case such as divorce, up until an FDR or financial dispute resolution hearing, which is the second of the three hearings. The next point the court will look at is, of course, in a very pragmatic way, the respondent's ability to be able to afford the repayments. In some ways, if you satisfy all of the Curry number 2 criterion, it does not matter if you can't satisfy the point about the other side paying the costs, because you will have a problem if the bank balances show nil in the Form Z if they've been exchanged by that point, in the sense that if there is no income coming through, because a court will not magic up money. And even if you satisfy all those criteria, say, well, I can see the other side hasn't got the funds, but I'll make them pay. So it's probably one of the most important points you need to consider. You also need to think about whether you can raise a loan against assets. It's also very unusual, though, however, to expect a court to ask that of you, but it's worth considering. Then you need to look at the duration of the order. And as I said, you need to go up to FDR, and the court will then reassess if you go to trial, and your solicitors will have to prepare further schedule up to trial at that stage. And if not agreed by the other side, you would need to go back to court to get an order for those further costs to be payable by the other side. Now, since 1st April 2013, sections 22ZA and 22ZB of the Matrimonial Causes Act 1973 allowed for the court to make legal services orders with statutory factors. Now, they're payable in instalments, so if your solicitors estimate something like £70,000 up to and including the FDR hearing, that will need to be tranched into various figures per month or fortnight, whatever the case may be, depending on the time frame up to FDR. The lump sum can be backed up with an interim order for sale as well. Though not specified, there is some case law proposing that there could be a charge over the other side's property to fund legal costs where there are no other resources made. And that's quite important if you reflect on what I said before about making sure you can see some visible funds coming into the other side's account on a regular basis, which will enable them to survive with their budget and pay your legal fees and pay their legal fees. So in most instances, you have to be quite wealthy to be able to pay your own fees and be ordered to pay the other side's fees, as well as meeting day-to-day costs of living. So it's not a surprise that there has been some call for there to be a change in the law under section 22ZA, so that the court can consider in a circumstance where the other side has not the sufficient funds but has other assets such as real property against which a charge could be made, that that should be done. Now, it would be hard to see how, if the other side had a real property against which a charge could be made that was a matrimonial asset, would not be enough to allow someone to get litigation lending. But lenders have their own criterion. I'm not a financial advisor. It's now post or still during COVID pandemic. So we're at an era and in an environment where lenders are more cautious. So it's worth bearing that in mind. And it's worth thinking outside the box and considering whether that's something that could be mooted to the court in really exceptional circumstances. So you have to still, under the new legislation, say that you can't get public funding from the legal aid agency, that you can't secure a loan to pay from at least two providers, and that you can't obtain a charge over a property. And so therefore you get to, if you pass those criteria, different types of legal services. So usually one would require advice about the law and about the proceedings and settling the case, as well as drafting documents, writing correspondence, and then also advice about enforcement consequences should an order be made against the other side but they fail to comply, because of course an order is a piece of paper and it doesn't enforce itself. Now, there is no statutory presumption that the payment should go only up to FDR, and the court can vary an order for that stage, but the common ground is to only include the provision up to that time. There's nothing, obviously, to prevent the other side from trying to get their own loan to avoid the legal services order being made against them. And in that instance, as with all court applications, it is always advisable to make attempts to negotiate a deal, so to speak, before launching into a court application, so that you can try to make a sensible arrangement without incurring additional and significant costs. So the court previously, before the new legislation came into place, was constrained on the legal services, and it was a bit loose, although there were cases to show that the court shouldn't penalise the receiving party of maintenance pending suit in also using that to meet the legal fees. Now the court can require the payment of a sum in advance, and usually in a sum of a series of sums and tranches. And the court can also defer the payment, but that's obviously not preferable, because one usually needs to pay their solicitors as and when bills are rendered, and monies usually need to be on account in advance of work being undertaken. Now, there can also be a direction that a property be sold in very exceptional circumstances where there is no income on the other side or no available asset against which one can add a charge, but it is extremely unusual for that to happen. Then, in terms of the process, you would make an application D11 under the Part 18 Family Procedure Rules 2010 procedure. You would also, obviously, if starting the proceedings, make the Form A alongside that application, and you would need to provide a statement in support together with a draft order. And the court will look at present circumstances and resources and responsibilities of both you and the other side, and it won't necessarily limit the order to the capital or income, but it will look at the realities of the situation. So where there are no substantial assets of a party, but there's been a track record on them relying on another family member, then the bounty, as they call it, will be presumed to continue up until trial. And that was discussed in the case of Rubin and Rubin under Mostyn's guidance. And then Mostyn also suggested that should extend to assessing whether a claim is speculative or doubtful owing to a jurisdictional challenge. court will also look at whether you've tried to avoid proceedings, hence why it's very important to try to do a pre-action letter or mediate, which you're obliged to do when considering advancing an application Form A, which I've discussed in previous episodes. It will also look at the effect on that opponent if they're ordered to pay your legal fees, because it shouldn't cause them such hardship which would be inequitable to disregard. And then it also must obviously look at whether they have their own solicitor, because if you're saying to the court that it's not a difficult case and the other side doesn't therefore need assistance but you need the assistance, and you want the other side to pay for your fees, I think that's extremely unattractive as an argument and you probably won't succeed. And then the applicant's conduct in the proceedings is looked at. So as I said earlier, you need to see closely, you have to look at yourself and see whether you have been unreasonable and litigated by correspondence, so to speak. So do be wary of that. And then you look at the amount that is owed for costs in the proceedings. And the court always has to look at the overriding objective when making the decision. And it's usually advisable that this is determined post Form Z being exchanged, because the difficulty in going forward with an application blind is that one doesn't know for sure whether there is sufficient funds in the other side's bank account to order them to pay your legal fees. Now, in terms of backdating costs, if the court has a case like this, then it will look at the guidance of Mostyn, Vreugde and Rubin. So if the court is satisfied that without the payment of the historic owed costs to your lawyers, you wouldn't be able to obtain future appropriate legal services, then it could make an order to pay those previous costs. But this has been refused in practice by Mr. Justice Holman. There are a couple of cases before Holman where the wife asked for arrears owing of some £115,000, which is quite small compared to the costs the firm had received as a whole. And many solicitors were usually willing to carry those costs through the proceedings, so he didn't make the order. And then there was another case where the wife asked for £200,000 of previous costs to be paid. And because they'd extended credit, they would have to basically grin and bear it until the end. So if there was a statement, however, by the partner at that firm that said they would definitely not be able to act if those £200,000 of fees were not met immediately, he probably would have acceded to the application for back payment to be made immediately. So then when you look at conduct, one has to look at repeated failed applications as well as litigating by way of correspondence. And then in terms of reimbursement of legal fees, they are capable of reimbursement, but be very wary that you probably need an unequivocal statement from the solicitor to say they can't continue without the payment made on account. And then there's also a pound for pound guidance or rationale, so to speak. So if a husband asks the wife to provide £1 for every pound that he had spent, there should be a quality of arms. And that's a good argument because it does show that there needs to be parity between the parties in court proceedings. And that case was originally in Mubarak. So then when you look at funding the proceedings, those are the criteria you need to consider. If you're in a Schedule 1 situation and not divorce, then one needs to use the same criterion. You can still apply. There is no bar to that, and the same is applicable under the Part 3 proceedings. It's very important to be very organised in the forecasting of the monies that are to be used. And so it's important that you think carefully, but also responsibly by waiting to get the disclosure so that you have evidence of affordability. And if it is not affordable or reasonable to ask the other side to pay those costs, whether in exceptional circumstances there is another real asset which could be used to get a charge, or investigating whether the other side could raise a loan instead so they're not out of pocket. So I hope you found this helpful. It's a very complicated area of law, but in fact, it's a fairly simple request. You're asking the court to make an order that the other side pays your legal costs, totalling X, made payable to your law firm's client account by such and such a date per month, starting from X month up until X month to cover the funds up to and including the FDR. And if you really wanted to, your solicitor could even project costs from FDR up to trial. I hope that you found this useful. Thanks for listening again.